And my name, I have to say every time for the person on the tape, if the tape is going, is John Leonard. And the theme that I'm talking about is healing our world. And today is healing our world by living out our core values. Not going to be a full hour class today because I happen to be preaching at Vespers, which starts at 7 tonight. And I'm afraid the pastor will panic if she doesn't see me over there. So we'll probably go about 45 minutes or so. The section, I've been taking different parts of the Sermon on the Mount and applying them to healing our world. So the first day was the Beatitudes. The second day was salt and light. Today is the law and the gospel. Tomorrow will be prayer, part one, and the next day will be prayer, part two. I wish I could have talked about almsgiving and fasting in there too, but it can only take so much. I don't think I said this in any of the classes. When I retired from teaching, I was interviewed by some seventh grade kids at St. Joe's, which is the last place I taught in Seattle. And they said, "Well, Mr. Leonard, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, if I get the energy, I think I would like to write a book." And, "Well, what do you want to write a book on?" Like, "You don't know anything." I said, I would like to write a book on the Sermon on the Mount, because Matthew is my favorite gospel. I just fall in love with Matthew. The reason I fall in love with Matthew was it was written for Jewish Christians, and I used to teach Hebrew scripture, and so I love Hebrew scripture, so I just relate it to Matthew. And I said, I'd like to write a book on the Sermon on the Mount, and I'd like to illustrate it with stories. Well, that's what I'm doing. When my wife, who teaches at Antioch University in Seattle, she was a principal, so we used to have time off together. Then she retired and then got a job and was working in the summer. And so when she started that and I started feeling the boredom of retirement and not knowing what I was doing, I thought, well, you said you were going to write a book. So far I've got 114 pages written. And I read it the other day and I actually liked it. No one else has said that. Well, we're going to do what we've done every other time. We're going to begin. Our prayer will be a song, okay? And I say living out our core values, and that means that yesterday I talked about salt and light, witness and service. This kind of carries on that theme that we have to carry our values into our world. And so here we go.
Here I am. who sings gospel music and just needed something to move to for a minute.
Wanted to wake up here. I thought that would wake us up a little bit here. There was a horse salesman named Joe Morgan. And Joe had sold horses forever and ever and ever, and he was older, and now his sons had taken over the business. But a friend of his called him up one day, and his friend's name was Jim. And Jim says, "Joe, I'm looking for a horse." "Oh, my sons can take care of that." "I'm looking for a superior horse." Oh, Joe thought. His sons couldn't find a superior horse. He was certain of that. So he said, "Well, I have a friend, Lee, and he can find a superior horse for you. It may take a little while, but he can find it. Guaranteed." So his friend Jim said, "Okay, Joe, give me his phone number." So Jim called up Lee and said he was looking for a superior horse. That's all he wanted, a superior horse. Could he find it? Lee says, "I think I can find it." Well, 1 week went by, nothing. 2 weeks went by, nothing. 3 weeks went by, Jim got a phone call from Lee. "I found the horse. Is it superior?" "Yes, I think it is superior." "What kind is it?" He says, "It's a white mare." "Good." And then Lee said, "I'm putting it on the train and you can pick it up at the train station probably in 2 days." "Okay, great." So Jim was really anxious to get down and find this horse, this superior horse that this Lee had sent him. And so he goes down and they're unloading the train, and the only horse that there is a great big black stallion. And it had a sign on it that said it was for Jim. So Jim went out to Joe and he says, "Joe, Lee is not good at judging horses. I asked him what the horse was. He said, it's a white mare, and I went down and picked it up, and it's a black stallion. He can't tell color, he can't tell sex. Terrible." All of a sudden, Joe said, "Lee is better than I thought. Much better than I thought. He ignores what's unimportant and only looks at what's essential. He ignores the appearances and looks for the essence." And the horse turned out to be a superior horse. In this section on the old law and the new law, I think that Jesus is like Lee. He's getting to the essence. He's getting beyond the things that people were looking at all the time, at getting at what's behind the law. And, you know, the Jews, the rabbis at the time of Jesus, had 613 different precepts that the people were supposed to follow. And Jesus just says that what I want is submission to the will of God that goes beyond observance of the law. And then we have this section in Matthew's gospel that when I first looked at, I thought, how in the world am I ever going to write about this? First part's anger. I'll read a little bit of it. Concerning anger. "You've heard it said to those ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with your brother or your sister, you'll be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go first be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift." Part of it. It's a powerful statement. So, do not murder. I say, don't even be angry. When I talk with kids about this, I have to say, now you got to make a distinction between being angry and having feelings of anger. Because I said, if someone came along and stole my car, I would be angry. So what Jesus is talking about here is that angry attitude that you keep having, okay? And the actions that you take from the thing. The feelings of anger you can't control. But maybe you can. I can't. So if something makes me angry, you know, it makes me angry. But it's that keeping that bitter attitude all the time and going on. Louis Eveleigh, who was a spiritual writer that I read, I would guess 1956. He wrote a book called That Man Is You. And there was a section in the book that I think fits this thing, and I can remember it. I don't know where the book is. I may have a copy someplace. But I love the book. And in the book, That Man Is You, Eveleigh says, you are no closer to God in church than you are to the person on your right and the person on your left. And then he goes on and says, if you cannot swallow the life of the person on the right and the person on the left, then you have no right to go up and swallow the body and blood of Christ. Powerful statement, but I think very true. We're no closer to God than we are to our neighbors. Think about it. And what does anger do to that relationship we have with our neighbors? And do we brood on anger and get mad at them? There's a story told of two Nazi war prisoners who met long after they'd been let free by the Nazis. And one of them says to the other, he says, can you forgive the Nazis and can you forget what happened and what they did to you? And the second one says, I will never forgive them and I will never forget it. And the first man said, then they still have you in the concentration camp. Second section concerning adultery. You've heard that it was said that you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. I don't know how many years ago, but I would guess, 30, maybe not that long ago. Now, in the 1970s in Seattle, late 70s, I think, there was an article in the newspaper. The article was about a student at the University of Washington who had gone down to the Montlake Cut, which, if you know Seattle at all, it's the little canal that goes between Lake Washington and Lake Union. And there's a bridge that goes over it, and the university's right there. Part of the university is kind of looks out on Lake Washington, part of it looks out on Lake Union. And this guy had gone down there to the Montlake Cut and he had plucked out his eye. And somebody came along and found the eye on the cut. And I don't know if they could ever repair that. I didn't hear anything else about it, but it was somebody who took this passage literally. Someone who took the passage literally. And I think that if we took the passage literally, we would see a lot of people who couldn't see very well. Okay. So we're to see other persons with dignity. That's the point of the passage. We're to see other persons with dignity, not as objects of sexual desire or gratification. Reminds me of a story of a priest. This priest did some of his work with prostitutes, but he was also a parish priest, and his parishioners were very upset that here was their priest and he was with these prostitutes all the time. And so they went to the bishop and they said, Your Holiness, he said, Your Excellency, he says, you know, our pastor is always talking with prostitutes. You got to do something about it. So the bishop called in the priest. And the bishop told the priest what the concern was of the people in his parish, and here's the response of the priest. Your Excellency, I have always held that it is better to talk with a pretty woman with one's thoughts on God than to pray to God with one's thoughts fixed on a pretty woman. That makes sense. And where I got the story was from Anthony DeMello, who is by far one of the best storytellers I've ever seen. I've got all his books, maybe six of them, and he died very young. He was an Indian Jesuit, and he has books, just tons and tons and tons of books, all kinds of books, and they're filled with stories, usually short stories. But after this story, DeMello writes the following. When the monk goes to a tavern, the tavern becomes his cell. When the drunk goes to a cell, the cell becomes his tavern. So you bring the attitude with you. Third section here, we got all these little things here. Stop me anytime you want me to stop, or if you want to make a comment, don't feel free. Divorce. Okay, it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now we know that's a hard saying. And we know that probably half the marriages in the United States end in divorce, something like that. The percentages change. But a very hard saying. And then Jesus is holding out the ideal. And later on, Paul uses the image of, you know, Jesus married to the church. And in the Catholic Church, they use marriage as a symbol of Jesus' love for the church. So obviously, the stricture on divorce is even stronger. You know, this is Christ's love for the church. Well, Christ doesn't abandon the church. The church may abandon Christ, however, every now and then. And, you know, maybe we expect too much from the spouse or when we get married. Maybe that's why we get people end up in divorce. I don't know why people get divorced so often, but it's certainly I went through a divorce, and I know darn well why I went through a divorce. My wife divorced me, and it's because I was a drunk. I was an alcoholic, and even the threat of divorce wouldn't stop me. Wouldn't stop me. That's how addictive alcohol is. It's when I had my job on the line that I finally went to treatment, but then it was too late for marriage, and then I was very blessed to meet Lila later on. I never planned to get married again. But maybe we expect too much. In Sufi literature, there is this character that Anthony DeMello talks about all the time. His name is Nasruddin. And Nasruddin is always in these strange situations. So one time this guy comes up to Nasruddin and he says, Nasruddin, I'm getting married, I'm getting married. And then he says, Nasruddin, are you married? And Nasruddin says, well, he says, years ago, I was looking for the perfect wife. And I found this woman and she was gorgeous. And she was intelligent and so much fun to talk with. But she didn't have any faith. And then I found this other woman, and she had faith, and she was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. But she couldn't put two words together in a conversation. And finally, I found her. Beautiful, intelligent, filled with faith, able to communicate. I found the perfect woman. And his friend said, did you marry her? And Nasruddin goes, no, she was looking for the perfect husband. Oh, And that's kind of the way that Nasruddin stories always go. I do have a story about marriage that to me says a lot. And if you've been to class here before, you'll notice I say about every fifth story, this is one of my favorites. This is one of my favorites. There was a Jewish couple, very, very much in love, and they got married. And they lived together in happiness, and he did very well in business, and things were just going great, except what? No children. I told a story the other day about no children. They didn't have any children, and they didn't know whose fault it was. They didn't go to a doctor at this point in history and let them say, oh, the woman is sterile or the man is, you know, is sterile. No, they didn't know what it was. It could have been the man, it could have been the woman. And they were really, really upset because they really wanted children. And they were talking about it one day and they said, you know, maybe we should get divorced. And if we get divorced and then we remarry, then maybe one of us can have children. We don't know who's at fault here, but maybe one of us can have children. And I know we both want children. And what's a marriage without children? And oh, let's go talk to the rabbi. So they went to the rabbi and they said to the rabbi, we love each other, but we cannot have children. And we both value the idea of having children. And so we want to know if it's all right to get divorced and then get remarried later on, and then maybe one of us will have children. And the rabbi said, fine. But the rabbi then said, what I want you to do is, before you separate for the final time, I want you to have a feast, just like you had a feast when you got married. Will you do that? And they looked at each other and they said, yes. Because neither one wanted to separate. But we will have a feast. So in walking on home on the way from the rabbis to their house, the husband turned to the wife and he says, honey, he said, I love you. I love you more than I can even put in words. And when we separate, I'd like you to take the most precious thing in the house. And I know you love the pictures we have in the front hallway, those paintings that are very, very expensive. And I know you like some of our silver. Take the silverware, take whatever you want. Take the most precious thing in the house, okay? She said, well, I'm going to have to think about that. That's really hard. Take it. Take it as a sign of my love. Well, they went along for 4 weeks, and then they decided it was time to make the separation. And in time to make the separation, it was also time to have their dinner. And she spent the day before and all that day getting all of his favorite dishes ready. Just all these little bits of his favorite dishes. So when it was time for the feast, they had the candles lit on the table, and they had wine, and she'd pour wine for him, and then she'd bring out the first dish, and he'd eat it and drink wine, and oh, honey, that is so good. I'm going to miss that so much. Then she'd bring out the second dish, and she'd fill up his glass of wine, and he'd eat a little bit. And they weren't very big dishes because there was a lot of different kinds of food. And he ate the food and drank the glass of wine. Then the third dish, and she filled up his glass of wine again. And the fourth dish, and she filled up his glass of wine again. And the fifth dish, and she filled up his glass of wine again. Sixth dish, he filled up the glass of wine again. Seventh dish, he kind of went, "Coop!" When he passed out at table, she called in the servant. She said, put him in the wagon and take him to my folks' house. So, the next day, the husband wakes up in this bed and he doesn't know any idea where he is. And he's got this terrible, 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 terrible hangover. Oh, it's terrible. Oh, what a headache, he says. Oh, and he's like, where in the world am I? And he looks around, doesn't recognize anything. And then his wife walks into the room. He says, where am I? Huh? Where? I don't know where I am. You're in my folks' house. Huh? You're in the house of my mother and father. Huh? My mother and father's house. You know them. Your in-laws. Oh, yeah. What am I doing here? She said, you told me I could take the most precious thing in the house when we divorced. So I did. And they stayed married. And in the lines of a good Jewish story, what happens? They had children. Concerning oaths. Again, you've heard it said, you heard that it was said of those of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you made to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. And in my case, not make one hair grow. Well, this is a passage that the Quakers take literally. The Quaker will not take an oath. And if you think about it, why should we need to take oaths? Shouldn't we just tell the truth? You know? Shouldn't we just tell the truth? And I've always admired the Quakers because they thought, you know, telling the truth is just one of the things that we do is being human, being Quaker. We tell the truth. Well, when we don't tell the truth, sometimes it has strange consequences. One time there was this reporter driving through the country, and he came to this little town, and there was an accident in the middle of the town, and all the people were around this accident. So he pulled the car over, and he thought, I gotta get in and write this up. This is a good story. I got a story for the newspaper. So he tried to tap people on the shoulder so he could get through the accident, and they just ignored him. So no matter who he tapped on, no. So finally he says, I'm the father of the victim. Let me through. Well, they all parted. And he came up, and then he looked down on the street. And there, lying in the street, was a dead jackass.
Yeah.
Then retaliation. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants tomorrow from you. And I have to admit that when I was writing this part of the book, it was right before we were going to go to war against Iraq. I also have to admit to you that I'm a pacifist, so obviously I was opposed to the war. And I have to say that I'm Catholic, and in Catholic Church, what's one of the big things about war? The just war theory, with the four conditions that are necessary to go to war. The church, or the Christianity, Christians in general, have not taken this too seriously, and we can make arguments for the just war theory. At least if we're going to have a war, let's make all four of these things true. I remember when I taught at Forest Ridge, my best friend at Forest Ridge did a senior seminar, and he said, let's do one on the Revolutionary War. He says, why don't you come in and talk about the just war theory? And then I'll talk about the Revolutionary War. And so I gave the four conditions necessary for a just war. And he hadn't heard them before. And then when I finished, he said, judging by what Mr. Leonard said, the Revolutionary War was not a just war. You know, it has to be the last thing you can do, so. Strange. Well, when I thought about war and I thought about peace and the lack of peace in our world, I remembered a Muslim story. And I was so glad that this is a Muslim story. It's called The Sword of Asharef. Legend had it that in northern Africa, in a country that we would now call Morocco, The legend was, and the story was, and everybody knew the story, that whoever possessed the sword of Ashereph could conquer the world. All you needed was this sword, but no one knew where the sword was. Well, one king decided that the one thing he really wanted to do was to conquer all of northern Africa. And so he sent his people out, and they looked, and they looked, and they looked, and they looked. And they got into this cave, and in the cave they found this sword and a scabbard. And by the way the handle was made, very fancy, the man who found it knew this was the sword of Ashereph. So he picked up the sword and the scabbard, and he brought it back to the king. And he gave it to the king, and the king saw the handle, and he too knew that this was the sword of Ashereph. So the next day he called his soldiers together, and he held up the sword, and he says, "Behold, the sword of Ashereph! We shall conquer the world! Tomorrow we will go against our enemies." And they were all excited because they would have power and they would have wealth and they would be in charge of their part of the world. So the next day they all gathered and they went to war against the neighboring kingdom. And the people in the neighboring kingdom heard that they had found the sword of Ashereph. And they knew that no matter what they did, they would be conquered because whoever had this sword would conquer the world. But they would fight anyway. Better to go down nobly, they thought. And so the king, with the sword in his scabbard at his side, took off. And they met the enemy, and he pulled the sword out, and he whopped off the head of one of the soldiers. He felt so powerful. And he came along, and then he saw another soldier, and he split his head in two. Oh, this is great. And he saw another one, and he was coming right at him to get him, and he took the sword and plunged it right into his stomach and pulled it out. Obviously, the sword was just filled with blood, and there was the third person down, and the sword of Ashereph was working. And he was so proud and so happy and so powerful that now he had the sword of Ashereph. But the next thing he knew, a spear hit him in the back, and he fell off his horse onto the ground with the sword in his hand. And he wasn't killed, but as he lay there trying to get his strength back to get up, the enemy came with a spear and plunged it right into his heart, and he died. Well, when his soldiers saw that here with the sword of Ashereph, and he still lost, they couldn't figure out what in the world had happened, and so they fled. The people took the sword and put it back into the scabbard, and they brought the sword to their king. And the king put it in his room. The next day, the king got up and decided, this sword doesn't seem to work. So he took the sword and he pulled it out of the scabbard, and then he got a cloth and he wiped off all the blood and cleaned up the sword. Michael, sort of like you and I were doing today in the kitchen. We had kitchen duty today at lunch. So cleaned up this sword. And there, written on the blade of the sword in Arabic figures, were the words, "Not by the sword shall you conquer, but by understanding and justice and love." And the new king took those words to heart, and he conquered and united what we now call Morocco. Isn't that a nice story? And it's nice to hear that it's Muslim. There's another story about peacemakers or not using violence that I like. Terry Dobson tells a story that he was studying once in Japan. And he was on the train, and the train was very, very quiet. And Terry at that point was taking Aikido, a Japanese martial art. But his instructor, even though Terry was taking it as a martial art, his instructor said that Aikido is really the art of reconciliation. Well, Terry was on the train one day, and things were quiet. It was kind of boring, as it is, riding trains on long distances. And then this drunk got on. He got on it, and he pushed this woman and this child, and they slipped and fell. and people started moving back, and he was just totally obnoxious. And Terry thought to himself, I'm going to practice my Aikido on him. I'll teach him a lesson or two. So Terry started making funny faces and nye, 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 at this Japanese guy. And the Japanese guy glared at him and glared and glared and says, okay, you're gonna get it. And as he started down towards Terry, and Terry was all excited because now he could use his martial arts, this older man says, hey, what have you been drinking? And the drunk says, I've been drinking sake. And the man in the seat said, oh yes, he says, my wife and I, who is 76, we spend every evening when the weather is nice out in the garden and we drink sake and we look at the flowers and we smell the flowers and we just love that. And the drunk says, oh, he says, my wife died a year ago. And the older man in the bench said, why don't you sit down with me? So the guy sat down and they started talking. And it was time for Terry to get off the train. When he got off the train, he looked back and he saw the drunken man with his head on the lap of the man next to him, sleeping. And Terry said to himself, I just witnessed Aikido, and the essence of Aikido is love. Now, love for enemies. Stop me if you want to. The last part, and I wanted to stop at quarter two, so this is about it. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. You know that passage. Well, I can remember when I was in eighth grade. I don't remember very many things about eighth grade. But I remember this in eighth grade. I remember who my teacher was, Sister Muriel. And Catholic grade school, Sister Muriel, with all this stuff on, you know. And we used to get a publication every week. And the publication we got would always have the Sunday readings in it. And one week, the reading was this one about loving your enemy. And the guys in the class, I being one of them, ha, 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 isn't that stupid? And Sister Muriel heard us, and she said, yes, you can love enemies. No, you can't. Then she went on to explain to us something that I've never forgotten. She said, love is much, much more than feelings. Love is an attitude. Love is a choice. You can love your enemies. And I thought, that's true. In 1986, in April, two gray-haired men, one Japanese, one American, met in an airport in Tokyo. They had met each other once before but never spoken during World War II. The American was in a cave and he had found a 5-year-old Japanese boy who was wounded and needed care. And he reached down and he cleaned up the boy as best he could, but he knew he had to get him back to some medics. And so, as he picked him up to take him to the medics, from the back of the cave, this Japanese soldier came out with his rifle. The rifle pointed at the American soldier. And the American soldier thought, well, there's nothing I can do. I know I'm going to die, but at least I'll die trying to help somebody else. And so he just continued to walk towards the place where the medics were, a ways away. And the Japanese soldier kept his rifle trained on him, but never pulled the trigger. Well, years after the war, actually 40 years after the war, as you can tell, that took place in 86, the American put an ad in a Japanese paper telling this story and saying, if you read this and are still alive, please contact me because I would like to meet you in person. And so the two people who met were the sniper for the Japanese and the American soldier, and they became friends. another story, also from World War II. I want to get the quote this man had. It's about a Private Schultz. Private Schultz was a private in the German army, and he was stationed in Yugoslavia, and he hadn't really done anything. And one time this officer came and said, "We're going up into the hills, so bring your rifles." So Private Schultz got his rifle, and they started up into the hills, thinking they were going on another training outing. And when they got up in the hills, they found 8 Yugoslavs, 5 men, 3 women. And the officer said, "Get your rifles ready. We are going to kill the enemy." And at that point, Private Schultz took his rifle, put it on the ground, walked over, and stood with the Yugoslavs. The officer said, "Ready, aim, fire." All 9 people were killed, one of them being German, by the name of Private Schultz. When they buried him later on, they discovered in his pocket the following quotation: "Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres." How brave can a man be? And my final story, since I need to quit early, and then we'll end with a song. It's a story taken of an African-American who lived in a small town. He had a house. He lived in the house forever. And he had taught all kinds of the white kids in the town how to fish, how to hunt, how to do all kinds of things. Well, he was respected by the people, and then they discovered copper ran through his property underneath his house. So the people kept thinking, "Oh, it'd be really neat to have that house." And then the price of copper went up, and so the people came out and said, "Either you give up the house, or you will be done away with." And the old black man said, "Well, you know, I've lived here all my life, and I don't think I can give up the house." "Watch out for tomorrow," they said. Well, the local minister heard about this, and so the next morning he came out and visited with the African American, and then all these people came out and they had white masks like the Ku Klux Klan, and they were ready to kill the African American. And the white minister went out and he said, "Well, I came out here to help George write his last will and testament, so I want to read part of it." It says here, "To Terry, I give my fishing reel. I remember the first time I taught you how to fish and you caught that 5-pound bass. To Jerry, I give you my rifle. I remember when I taught you how to shoot a rifle, and then you went on to win a marksmanship award." Gradually, the people went away one by one because their name was read in the will, and they all disappeared. And when they had all disappeared, the grandson of the old man looked up at him and he says, "Grandpa, what kind of a will was that?" And the grandpa looked at his grandson and said, "It was the will of God, son, the will of God." Now the chapter 5 of Matthew, ends with the words, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." And I'd like to end with a song by a singer that I love, and a song that I love, from a musical that I love. All these things work together. I gotta get my glasses or I won't be able to figure out what's the number I'm looking for here. Even with the glasses, I don't see very well. I'll look on the back here, I can read that. Okay, so here we go. The singer is Judy Collins. something.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to have